ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Mount Spur last erupted 33 years ago, and the volcano near Anchorage is now restless again, prompting South Central residents to prepare for a new explosive event that could come in the next few weeks or months. How likely is an eruption, and how much damage could it cause for health, air travel, and day-to-day life? And does your dog really need those goggles? Scientists and health experts join us to answer your questions about how to best prepare for the potential of volcanic ash fall today on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report. From local businesses to fiscal policy to big industries like fishing, tourism, and oil and gas, I'll cover the high-stakes economic issues that matter to Alaskans all over the state. That's the Alaska Economic Report with me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello from Alaska Public Media. It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. When Mount Spur, located about 80 miles west of Anchorage, last blew, it was 1992, and the volcano erupted three times in June, August, and September. Nearly 50 years before that, Mount Spur erupted in 1953, only once. Redoubt, which is south of Mount Spur, last erupted in 2009. After a few months of going from yellow to orange and back, it finally blew up on March 29, 2009. The eruptions lasted for months, and ash shot as high as 65,000 feet. So, can you predict exactly when, how big, and how long a volcano will erupt? No. They're quite persnickety about being predictable. So we need scientists to help us understand the risk, make calm plans, and then hope that if an eruption of Mount Spur does happen in the coming months, the wind blows it away from us. But being prepared for some ash fall is important, and our guest today will help us better understand the risk, sensible steps we can take to protect our health, our property, and our dog's eyes. In the studio today is Christy Wallace. Christy is a volcanologist with the Alaska Volcano Observatory. Also in the studio is Dr. George Conway. Dr. Conway is the Chief Medical Officer for the Anchorage Health Department. And Carrie Wiedeker is also with us today. Carrie is the Disaster Recovery Coordinator for the City of Anchorage. Welcome, all of you. Thanks so much for being here in the studio with me today.
Thank you.
Great.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's great. We'll be able to answer questions. We've got lots of questions. You can also join our discussion. Are you wondering how to best prepare to stay safe if ash falls on Anchorage and surrounding communities? Were you here when Mount Spur erupted in 1992? What are your biggest concerns about protecting your family and your property? You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. We solicited questions earlier online through our engagement tool called Harken, so we'll bring some of those questions to our experts today. There were a lot of them, about 50, I think. Christy, start us off here. Talk about what you see today with Mount Spur and how has that activity been over the last week or so? Is it somewhat the same? Do you see more signs of elevated activity? What's happening today?
Great question. Yeah, so about once a week, we kind of update our talking points at the observatory. And so I was just doing that this morning, actually. So what's kind of going on at Mount Spur is the elevated earthquake activity continues. A little bit of a decline in the past week. We had about 67 earthquakes recorded. In weeks prior, it was anywhere between 80 and 100. So a tiny decline, but not considered significant. Deformation also has declined or sort of halted. We've seen this before in November and December, and so also not, we don't think, very significant. So some possible decline in the deformation, which of course is the magma that's moved into the volcano. It had inflated about 2.5 inches. So right now that's kind of paused. We are seeing an increase in steaming, or at least visible steaming, from the summit crater. That a lot of people have sent us photographs in the last week. I think it was Wednesday when it was just spectacular. The sunset was great and everyone noticed it. And this happens a lot, not just at Spur, but at other volcanoes where we get a lot of calls thinking, what's going on? But we also don't think that that has to do with increased activity. It mainly has to do with atmospheric conditions. You could just see that steaming a little bit better and it looked more robust, but we also don't think that that was significant. So continued steaming from the summit. We're also seeing steaming from fumaroles within Crater Peak, and that's relatively new. We didn't start seeing those until early March. So that's continuing, and we're seeing, just some surface movements inside the summit crater. Ice continues to collapse into the lake. The fumaroles themselves are now kind of exposed and no longer underwater, and so that might also contribute to seeing a little bit more steam. But yeah, that's kind of what's going on. We're still in the same posture in terms of what we think might happen. We don't see any of these as significant declines. It's sort of steady as it goes this week.
And is there any history to suggest that maybe this is part of what happens, that it calms down a little bit before an eruption? Have you seen that at all?
Sometimes. I think usually we think of that during eruptions, when there might be one explosion and then some time between the next explosion. Often if we see a decline in activity, one, it's because it just erupted, or that it's kind of building up pressure. There might be a dome or something in there. Right now, there's no dome that we're aware of. And so we do have information from the 1992 eruption, not 1953, but from 1992, that shows that these sort of waxing and waning of earthquake activity is pretty common. Also, the location of earthquakes is fairly well distributed around the volcano, maybe a little more towards the summit area. At one point, it was concentrated, under Crater Peak, which was of concern, and then it moved away. But when we went back and looked at past earthquake data from 92, we saw that happened numerous times, sort of moving back and forth. So right now, we're just monitoring the whole volcano, regardless of what vent the earthquakes might be under. But currently, they're kind of distributed.
And Christy, for Anchorage, the primary risk is winds carrying an ash cloud over the city. But even if it goes in the other direction, there is still concern for air travel, correct?
Absolutely. That is our number one hazard in Alaska from eruptions. It's volcanic ash and those airborne clouds that can travel hundreds of miles, sometimes circling the whole Earth. And so there can be impacts that are quite far traveled.
They could go on for
a long time.
Days.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah. Maybe not in Anchorage, point in, even places not in Alaska will experience impacts.
Dr. Conway, respiratory problems, ash from a volcano is finer than wood ash, also a lot more abrasive. Talk about this potential concern. This type of ash can get deeper into lungs. What additional health problems can this create?
Well, there's probably going to be a range of sizes, and dependent upon the origin and where it comes out of the volcano, the characterization could be different.
Oh, interesting.
But most volcanic ashes have at least a large percentage of silica, so basically the same thing as sand or glass. And as a result, the microparticles can be quite sharp and small. So, you mentioned wildfire smoke, so the preparation that you'd take for this is very similar to what you'd do for if there's a wildfire and there's heavy smoke. The main thing we're concerned about, the particles of any size could irritate your eyes and may make you cough just from having them in your mouth and your main airways. So some sort of goggles may be helpful, especially if you have to clean up and whatnot. The problem with a lot of safety goggles is they have holes in the side so you could dry your sweat. So you'd want to tape those over. or we can use swim goggles, but just plan on throwing them away at the end of it because they're going to get scratched. As far as the human health, the main concern that we have is what we call small respirable particles. So that's what we call PM2.5, which is very small. During COVID, everybody became familiar with N95 masks, and those are designed specifically to exclude those very small particles. And the hazard from both wildfire smoke, the carbon and other chemicals in that, and the sharp carbon fibers, as well as in the silicaceous volcanic output, is the very small ones that can get not only into your main airways and maybe make you cough or sneeze, but to go down into your end airways and then get into the tiny sacs, alveoli, which are the ones that we exchange oxygen for carbon dioxide to basically the way that we survive. Those tiny particles can go through that membrane. You could, in theory, if you were exposed enough, you could start clogging the actual physical transfer. Mm-hmm. But the main concern is the tiny particles, whether they're silicates or glass-like particles or carbon that would be from smoke, can go through that and then potentially cause some downstream havoc in our circulatory system. So that we know that people that are exposed long-term to silicates as miners and whatnot else can develop both pneumoconiosis, clogging of the lungs, but also they can develop some circulatory and other downstream effects, the same way with people that work in smog, and you know, people like that collect in toll booths and whatnot have very high exposure, can develop that. The chances of that happening after just one volcanic eruption is low. However, if you have people that already have an underlying health issue, whether it's cardiovascular or respiratory, so maybe it's asthmatic, it may trigger that. So what we recommend is having these masks available, reducing infiltration of any dusts from this into the home by keeping windows and doors closed, not opening and closing much. If you have to, if you have a lot of infiltration, taping just with like painter's tape or something you can pull off and throw away later. And then also making sure that people have an adequate supply of prescription medicine if they have some chronic respiratory problem, or if they're periodically asthmatic, to make sure that they can treat that. And then the same logic applies to the people that are fragile, whether it's cardiovascular or respiratory problems. They should really entirely shelter in place during some event like this. And even with respiratory protection, they probably just want to stay inside. Mm-hmm. And then people that have to go outside, whether they're tidying up or just checking things out or taking the dog out, should wear respiratory protection and goggles if there's any, not only tangible ashfall underfoot, but if there's any reduced visibility through the air that appears to be clouded by that.
And the dog?
What about the dog?
Well, social media is full of photos of people with their dogs with goggles and masks.
Those are really cute. And I like the dog, especially the orange dog one that's gone viral, the orange goggled dog. Good luck with getting your dog to wear a respirator of any sort or a mask. You can try. I think what I'd probably focus on is wearing my own respiration and making sure that the dog has, shall we say, an efficient journey outside that doesn't last very long.
Great advice. Thank you so much. Carrie, a big priority for city leaders and folks at the Alaska Volcano Observatory is coordinating messages if an eruption is imminent or occurring. Walk us through what Alaskans should know in this regard. Where will emergency messages originate and how will people get them?
Well, in Anchorage, we have an opt-in system called RAVE. We post it on our website. There's a pinned post on our Facebook page. You just go to muni.org and you can find it. People opt into that, and a lot of people don't even know that they're opted in. They just know that they get messages from the police department every once in a while when there's a road closed or whatever. But that is our primary system. And if the volcano goes off and if the ashfall is coming toward Anchorage, we can activate a federal system. We call it IPAWS. It's like the emergency alert system that can send it out to televisions and interrupt you on your phone. If we need to, we can certainly set that off. But the main message that we want everyone to get is that we just want to be prepared, and we want to ensure that we're all saying the same things. So, like Christy and our department and the National Weather Service, we've been talking about this since December, just getting on the same page as to the likelihood of an eruption and how we're going to respond to it. It's just a matter of coordinating and communicating.
All right, thank you. Christy, turning back to you, and I should remind our listeners that this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about how to prepare for a potential Mount Spur eruption, what you should know about having safety supplies at home, N95 masks, and maybe some swim goggles to protect your eyes when you go out. In the studio with me today is Dr. George Conway. Dr. Conway is the Chief Medical Officer for the Municipality of Anchorage. Christy Wallace is a volcanologist with the Alaska Volcano Observatory. And Carrie Wiedeker is the Anchorage Disaster Recovery Coordinator. You can call if you have questions or comments if you were here for the last Mount Spur eruption. Statewide, the number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. We'll get to some of those email questions in a bit. Christy, describe the alert level right now, right? Spur is at an aviation code yellow and alert level is advisory, correct? So
yes.
Talk about the differences in those two alerts. What?
So that's a really great question. We often tend to think of the color instead of the alert level, but we have this aviation color code, and that's really meant for the aviation industry. This is used around the world, and certainly within all of the U.S. observatories. The alert level is really for ground hazards. Okay, so we're at advisory. Normal green would be the lowest level sort of background, and advisory just indicates that there's something going on. There's unrest going on, and in this case at Mount Spur. And so what I can say is that we can toggle those two, the aviation color code and the alert level, apart. And where that might be a good idea is in Hawaii, for example, where there's no aviation hazard, but there might be a ground hazard of a lava flow. In Alaska, almost all of our volcanoes, if not all of them, have explosive eruptions. So there's always going to be some amount of explosive material and airborne ash. And so we have never separated the aviation color code and the alert level. We keep them the same. So it goes green normal, yellow advisory, orange watch, and red warning. And we'll keep that the same for the spur eruption. There would be no reason for us to separate them. We're trying to message to the community the use of the alert level more so than the aviation color code, just as a point of messaging and trying to, yeah, stay on track with what it really means.
Was there, I have to point out this really horrific headline that I happened to see scrolling along today. It's from some online outfit called the Daily Mail. And the headline is, "Earthquake hits U.S., sparking fears major volcano is about to erupt." So,
awesome.
Of course, a really ridiculous headline, and I'm sure artificial intelligence probably wrote it. But it said that the USGS detected a 3.7 magnitude quake this morning near Petersville. Was there one?
Good question. I don't know. I work on volcanic earthquakes and not on tectonic earthquakes. And so there's another program in the USGS that is monitoring earthquakes associated with, tectonic.
Just tectonic.
Yeah, exactly.
So clearly that wasn't related to.
Totally unrelated. And I mean, often we can have big tectonic earthquakes during times of unrest. I remember in 2009 at Redoubt, there was a really big earthquake that happened, you know, right in the middle of color code orange, and we thought, it's going to perturb the system, and it didn't do anything. It's not to say that tectonic earthquakes can't impact volcanoes. I mean, if you think of this magma that we say is moving up into the volcano, it's a malleable material. It's soft and fluid and moves around easily. And so if you have a very big earthquake, we call them telecisms. We can see those on our instruments as well. So yes, we surely detected that, and our seismologists would have said, oh, it's a regional or a tectonic earthquake, and those of us monitoring the volcano would have just gone back to bed.
Yeah, I mean, 3.4 is kind of a snoozer here in Alaska.
Kind of a snoozer, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
That's probably along that Castle Mountain. Is it Castle Mountain or Denali Fault? The same fault that the 2018 earthquake was along. Yeah, there's a fault line that runs along that area there.
There was a question that came in on Harkin online for us, someone asking about could the volcano's activity prompt a tectonic earthquake. Does that happen?
No.
Okay.
Yep. They're unrelated.
All right.
Yeah. So we put together, Carrie was talking about sort of the messaging and how we've all been working together. A big interagency group, stakeholders, emergency managers, the Volcano Observatory. We've been sort of putting all of our frequently asked questions together, and that was one of them. And in fact, that was one of the early questions, and there's an answer to that on ready.alaska.gov.
Great. Mm-hmm. Awesome. There's also lots of answers on our website as well, alaskapublic.org. Chrissy, you studied past eruptions right at the volcano. Tell us about what you're doing there and what you're learning about those past eruptions that could help you better understand what could be coming now.
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, I've been fortunate enough to be a geologist in Alaska, working on really amazing volcanoes and the highest threat volcanoes. So Spur is one of the high threat volcanoes in the U.S. And it's actually the first volcano I ever worked at. It's my thesis volcano. So I've spent quite a number of field seasons, which is quite short in Alaska because we have a lot of snow. So just weeks at a time, honestly. In 2004 and 5 and 11 and 12, different times going over to the volcano and trying to understand its eruptive history. So my specific expertise is in volcanic ash. It's the primary hazard in Alaska, and it's really the easiest way at understanding how often a volcano erupts. So if you try to look at lava flows or pyroclastic flows, those sort of bury each other, and it's really hard to dig into them. But ash falls can be distributed really far away. So I can work a few miles away from the volcano, or even, you know, further. I could work on the Kenai Peninsula or in Anchorage. I can core a lake and look at the sediment at the bottom of the lake and get an idea of how many times has ash fallen from various volcanoes in that location. So the way to really understand eruptive history at a volcano is to go pretty near the volcano, work a few miles around off the flanks in kind of flat-lying areas. Coring lakes is a great way of doing it. And then counting the layers, you know, how many ashfall layers are they? How thick are they? What's the grain size? That gives you a sense of how big those eruptions are. And also, where was the wind blowing? I mean, actually, at the end of my career, I think I'm going to know a lot about wind direction, maybe more than anything else. Where the wind has blown in the past, but in the last 10,000 years. So I'm usually looking at records that go from today all the way back to when ice was removed. And that is anywhere between 10 and 15,000 years in the Cook Inlet area. So it's a pretty long record. And what I can say is that most of the eruptions that come out of Spur Volcano come out of Crater Peak, which is the vent 2 miles on the south flank of the volcano. It's still part of the same volcano. It's called Mount Spur. It's just a satellite or side vent. So everything I see that comes out of there comes from Crater Peak. I have seen at least one eruption of the summit, which looks pretty different. It's kind of a white pumice versus a brown kind of dense rock that comes out of Crater Peak. But it wasn't super significant. It wasn't thick. And that was about 6,000 years ago. So we use the information from the past to infer what we think might happen today. And so that if you're hearing us say we think it's, if an eruption occurs, we think it will come from Crater Peak, even though the earthquakes are really all over the place, or sometimes they're really at the summit, why wouldn't it come from the summit? It could. It absolutely could. That's just not what we've seen for a very long time, 6,000 years. So, yeah.
When was the last time you were at Mount Spur?
Oh, I think I was over there last in 2012. Yeah, so I've been doing a lot of work on Mount Hayes volcano, biggest eruption in south central Alaska in in the Holocene, so the last 10,000 years. And there's big, thick ashfall deposits, many meters from that volcano. And so Spur is a great place to work because that's where a lot of ashfall was directed. So I was over there mostly working on Hayes Volcano, but haven't been over there, I think, since 2012.
One of the questions we had online was if there is an eruption, if ash comes toward the city, what does it smell like? And will there be noise?
Okay, that's great. Great question. Another one of the FAQs you can go to. So will there be noise? I would have said no until I put the question out to our staff and those who study noise and infrasound, which is actually not audible. And it turns out that in 92, some people were sensitive enough that they did hear sounds. And we know that around the world, people can hear eruptions, all the time. So yes, you could possibly hear it. And what was the second part of the question?
Well, it was about noise or smell.
Oh, smell. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Okay, smell. So, yes, it will probably smell like sulfur, like a match, striking of a match.
Deviled eggs.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, like eggs. That'll be something that might be a little bit alarming to people, but that's absolutely expected. And I remember in 2009, whenever we had people in the lab, I run a volcanic ash lab at the USGS, and we had so many samples in there, and the lab was just so stinky. And they thought, oh, is this safe to be in here? And I said, oh, yeah, that's just the smell of a fresh volcano. It's all normal.
Yeah. Smell of a fresh volcano. All right, so before we take a break here, Dr. Conway and Carrie, some guidance says that people should stay indoors for 4 hours. Where does that number come from? Is that just kind of a general guide?
It's definitely just a general guide. This is Carrie. Actually, it comes from Christy. In the past, previous eruptions, the ash fall, the active ash fall time has been roughly in that time frame. And that's the only time we absolutely recommend people stay inside is during the actual ash fall
event. Elevated in the air, suspended in the air.
Yeah, so that's our general guideline. When an actual eruption happens and we have an understanding of how much ash there is, what direction it's going, and some time frame expectations, we will put out more messaging. The experts at the Volcano Observatory and the National Weather Service will help us all figure out what we need to do, and we will put out recommendations as to how long people need to shelter in place. And we always, this is always a great opportunity to recommend people put together their disaster preparedness kits. Our website, ready.alaska.gov, the state website, all have recommendations that you have roughly a 2-week supply in an emergency preparedness kit for any instance of a disaster in Alaska.
Shelf stable food, things
yep,
like that, medications,
exactly.
Dog food, cat food, all those things. One question that came in to us was how far embers could travel. Concern about how dry things are already, snow is gone so early in the spring. And they had concerns about could the embers travel great distances and spark forest fires?
Oh, it's a good question. I've never seen any burnt material under or above an ashfall. So my general message is that, yeah, ashfalls are not hot. But if you're very close to the volcano, yes, you can get ballistics that are quite hot. So a ballistic would be kind of a larger block that is traveling through the air and can land on things and burn them. Sure, we've seen lots of charred materials, but those are usually from pyroclastic flows and not from ashfall itself. So I don't think that is a major concern.
All right. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with questions and guidance about how to stay safe if Mount Spur erupts as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Talk one-on-one with experts on mental health, nutrition, pharmacology, surgery, childcare, and much more on Line One, your health connection. Join our hosts as they discuss the health topics that matter to Alaskans with their guests and live callers. Email questions before, during, or after the live broadcast to line1@alaskapublic.org. That's Line One, your health connection, weekly on your local public radio station.
one 800 478 8255 is the number statewide if you'd like to join our conversation today, as we're talking about preparing for a potential Mount Spur eruption near Anchorage. 1-800-478-8255 is the statewide number. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org, as several people did. Ken writes, I was here for the last eruption. The thing that sticks in my mind is what a mess just a quarter inch of ash made and how long it stuck around. Should another eruption occur, what are the odds of it of a more significant amount of ash? He says, I shudder to think what 6 inches or more would be like. And interestingly enough, I was looking at some of the questions that came in through Harkin on our website and saw that one person had said, oh, this is incorrect information. It was 3 to 6 inches of ash that fell in 1992, not a quarter inch. So, Chrissy, set the record straight there.
It was absolutely not 3 to 6 inches. In fact, there's never been that amount of ash in South Central Alaska, except from Hayes Volcano about 3,600 years ago. So all ash falls from Crater Peak, Redoubt, Augustine have been millimeter scale. And the reason I know that is because we've cored local lakes, Campbell Lake, Goose Lake, and you can look at those layers in the lake bottom sediment, and they're all very, very small. In fact, the 92 eruption, you can't even discriminate it away from the 89-90 eruption of Redoubt. They're combined. And so you just, you know, measure that thickness, and then when I do the analyses, I see that it's a combination of Redoubt and Spur together, so it was very thin. That is actually a really important thing to think about, because we have a tool on our website that's called Is Ash Falling, where we're asking people to report ash fall, because we're working directly with the Weather Service to update the warning products, which are coming from the National Weather Service Anchorage Forecast Office. And if the ash falls are more or less, we want to get that information to them so they can update their products. And so one of the things that we ask on the website is yes or no. Is it falling or not falling? Both are important. But also, we do ask questions about thickness, but the map that we're showing the public never shows the thickness, because I'm telling you, doesn't matter if you're a scientist, everyone gets this wrong. We overestimate, and I don't know exactly why. Part of it could be that or during the cleanup process, and we're sweeping it into corners, or it falls on our car and kind of shifts down, you know, the windshield, and you start to measure that thickness instead of the original thickness. Anyway, what I know is it's always wrong, and so we don't even share that except with the Weather Service. And we always ask, can we call you to confirm? And we even put some tools on there, you know, take some pictures and put a scale in there, and then we can see for ourselves. So yeah, that's just, it happens all the time, even with scientists. Yeah.
So probably we're not going to see inches of ash fall. That's not likely.
That is not likely.
Not likely. Okay.
Not at all.
But Dr. Conway, in an earlier interview, you had talked about how unpredictable that ash could be on surfaces. It could be quite gritty, could be slippery.
Yes. So, hopefully, immediately or shortly post eruption, we'll get a much more granular characterization through. We were very fortunate to have a local volcano observatory. Not everybody has those, so we would probably have better characterization of that. That would give us better advice about that, whether or not it's slippery, as well as potentially the depth. To follow up on a couple of other questions, I think that after an ash fall, if the air is pristine and clear, and you can see far, That should be safe enough. It's the same guidance we use for wildfires. And I want to revise it, because it was said partially in jest about the pets. I mean, if you you wouldn't want your pets to be out long term in an ash fall. So if you can habituate them to masks and, you know, and goggles, that I don't think it'll hurt anything, but I don't know if it's the best use of time for based on the ornery ones that we've had.
Yeah. Dr. Conway, and maybe this is a question for you too, Carrie, are Anchorage officials working with people in Tyonek on any kind of evacuation plans if that becomes necessary? They're the closest to Mount Spur.
I haven't had any message about that. Or I don't know if that would be us or if that would be the Kenai Peninsula Borough who would be working with them, because I know they would probably fall within the borough's boundaries. And the borough is much more experienced with ashfall than we are, because they get volcanic ashfall even more frequently from Augustine and Redoubt and Spur, potentially.
I saw after the ash descends and falls, there was a couple questions here. One person asked, how long are these precautions needed after an eruption until it rains or the wind blows? I just saw an announcement yesterday from, I think it was AVO or National Weather Service, about suspended ash in Katmai from Nova Rupta in 1912. Come on, that's been a long time ago. So what do we need to know about that, about ash being resuspended if the wind blows? Once it rains, are we pretty well in a good spot? Or?
Well, I can speak to that a little bit. I mean, the Katmai situation is unique. There's 600 feet of ash over there that's being resuspended over the last 100-plus years. So no trees, no vegetation to hold it down to the ground. So during high winds, that gets picked up a few times a year. And we are reporting on that, as well as the National Weather Service. And it's an aviation hazard, which is why it's important. Potentially could be a hazard to humans on the ground, but we've done a study and don't think it's significant. So in Anchorage or all of South Central, if there is an ashfall event, wherever that ashfall occurs, that initial fallout, as Dr. Conway said, is, you know, staying indoors, shelter in place until, you know, you can go outside and see that the air is pretty clear. You will notice that as soon as everyone goes outside and starts cleaning up, which is a necessary evil, you got to get it cleaned up, it'll start to get resuspended again. So there will be a time period, especially during cleanup, where people really need to wear their protective equipment, masks, goggles. But, you know, the resuspension will potentially occur for weeks, months, and years. So we work with the Department of Environmental Conservation Air Quality Program, and they have data from 92 that says initially there wasn't the ash itself was quite coarse, actually, kind of a fine sand, and so it wasn't respirable, as Dr. Conway was talking about. But as soon as people were driving on it, it broke those
ground particles up.
Yeah, exactly. And then it became more respirable. So the air quality diminished with time instead of improved. So the resuspension, I think, is a long-term problem, and we'll be working with the National Weather Service on warning messages associated with resuspension. But that initial cleanup period will probably be dustier than the fallout event itself.
And with that idea in mind, Dr. Conway, the logistics, most of us can shelter in our homes if we need to, but getting homeless, people who are suffering from homelessness, how this could be really daunting to help folks that are unhoused. Is there a plan to supply any kind of protective gear for people, masks, goggles, other things?
There's a relatively intense discussion about how best to do that. There's tarps, and we've inventoried masks, N95 masks to distribute. We're going to do our best to encourage people that are unsheltered to be sheltered. I think trying to just protect yourself with a tarp and a mask could be problematic. And masks, especially if there's other irritants like ash that are accumulating, you don't want to be trying to sleep with a mask on. It's just another impediment. So we're doing our best to make sure there's adequate shelter space. And we're also discussing transportation options from large encampments where there may be a substantial number of individuals to be able to get them to shelter. The tarps might afford some protection for their things if they need to leave some things behind, if they won't fit in a tote or whatever. But we do encourage all people to take shelter. And then there's one other thing that isn't always mentioned, but if you have small children or anxious people at home, it's very important, especially if we have one of the ash falls where we have a transient black cloud, that to let people know that this is a predictable event. We're able to scale it. We're quite certain that it will be transient, and it's not an apocalyptic or catastrophic event. And we're very fortunate to have the means for real-time sensing that we have a very granular idea about the scale and the likely duration of the problem. So people could be very anxious about this and just reassure them that this is not something to be worried about as an existential threat. On the other hand, a lot of small measures like wearing some respiratory protection, staying inside, and then also equipping oneself to filter that, especially like during cleanup, because you can be rousing. Sure. If you start sweeping and whatnot, you can be rousing a lot of dust, are all very worthwhile as far as protecting both your comfort and your health.
Yeah, I mean, it's just taking some smart, common sense steps to protect your home, your health, your property. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Dan is gone. He's probably still in Homer, but he's not on the line. So, Carrie, you had talked in an earlier interview about protecting people who will be involved in cleaning up if ash floats over Anchorage. What are the thoughts about how that will get done, and how would cleanup of ash in the city take place?
Well, it's very similar to our normal street sweeping. And they are right now gearing up for the annual spring street sweeping. It's the same equipment that would be used to clean up our streets if there were a significant ash fall. But we're also talking about making sure that our employees at Solid Waste Services have protective gear for when they're working outside. And our Parks and Recreational Department employees, because they do a lot of external care and could potentially be exposed. So it's a matter of inventorying our supplies, talking to each department about what they have, what they need, who's going to stay on during an ash fall because it's an essential service, and who's going to be doing the actual cleanup work when the time comes.
What improvements have you seen, especially since the last eruption, 1992, for better understanding and preparing for air filtration, vehicles, electronic equipment? Anybody want to take that?
Well, that's a good question. So I don't know that there's improvements so much as in cleanup activities and things like this, but there have been improvements in how electronics are built. So in general, most electronics are pretty resilient to ashfall, and there's been numbers of studies now done on this type of thing. There's an international volcanic ash impacts working group that basically pulls from research around the world where ash falls occur and collates all of that information into a website. And if you just type in USGS volcanic ash impacts, it'll be the first thing that pops up. And there's just a wealth of information in there about ash impacts. And one of those is talking about electronics. And I'd say that, yeah, electronics are much more resilient now today than they have been in the past. I think a lot of people have learned from the past and put, you know, pre-filters on some of their systems, and that can be quite helpful. But I think most importantly, the guidance has really come a long ways, and there's a lot more resources available. There's posters that you can hang up in your offices if you're a facilities manager, all sorts of information, and that did not exist in 92.
The big change is awareness. Yeah. Right? We really just are all so much more aware of everything that's going on around us. I was here in 1992. I was a kid, so all I really remember about it is that my parents were farmers out in Palmer, and that they had to wear goggles and masks during harvesting because it stirred up so much of the volcanic ash. But that's the big thing, is that there's so much more messaging, so much more awareness of everything now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Dr. Conway.
So, some of the legacies of the COVID pandemic are that a lot of people still have masks and understand that technology and how to at least make sure that it fits reasonably well, seal test if not fit test. But also many public buildings, in order for us to be able to recommend reoccupancy, added filtration and air exchanges, whether they were schools, public, other public venues. So actually, sheltering in place is probably going to be more effective in this era post all of those preparations as well.
All right. We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion on preparing for the possibility of Mount Spurs eruption as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station.
Start your day with a quick look at the most important stories from around the state with Alaska Morning News, your dose of headlines each weekday morning. With reporters covering every corner of Alaska, you can be sure you're up to date on the stories that matter to Alaskans. Join me, Ava White, for Alaska Morning News, weekdays on your local public radio station. Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report. From local businesses to fiscal policy to big industries like fishing, tourism, and oil and gas, I'll cover the high-stakes economic issues that matter to Alaskans all over the state. That's the Alaska Economic Report with me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing preparations for if Mount Spur erupts and if an ash cloud blows toward populated areas, how to best be prepared so that you can keep yourself safe, your property, your health. You can join our conversation in the final 15 minutes or so, well, about 10 minutes or so of the show. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org, as Chris did. Chris says, I'm not sure if I can believe any of today's show. APRN has quite a history associated with April Fool's Day. Yes, it's true. But this is no joke, folks. Chris says, I was thinking of spreading ash on my car this morning, but realized I haven't got new air filters yet. So
go get those, Chris.
Yes, Chris. Get on it. Quit horsing around here with April Fool's jokes. But I have to mention, because it's just too perfect, today is the 1st of April. And there is a story that just popped up a few days ago in Forbes magazine that says one of the greatest April Fool's Day pranks ever involved a fake volcanic eruption. And it's all about Mount Edgecumbe in 1974 on April 1st. Residents in Sitka saw smoke coming out of Mount Edgecumbe, and apparently this man that was quite the prankster waited 3 years until he had a clear day on April 1st and then hauled a bunch of tires up there, lit them on fire, and then stamped April Fool's in the snow. What an epic joke. I really appreciate good joke telling.
I don't think that would go over as well today.
No, I do not think so. I think he would get in lots of trouble if you tried something like that today. And, of course, this is no joke. This is actually a big consideration and a concern for us here in South Central, is that Mount Spur could erupt in the next few weeks or months, and people should just make some calm preparations to be prepared for that. So I wanted to ask about Christy, your career is focused on volcanic ash, and talk about why it's hazardous, but are there also things in that could be good for the soil?
Oh, sure. Yeah, so for the most part, I always say that ash falls in Alaska are more of a nuisance than a hazard, right? So the nuisance part is it's messy. We talked about this. If it's really fine grain, you know, ash is tiny particles, and it's a big mess. So cleanup is a bigger issue. Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Well, I was just wondering about the possible nutrient.
So there's, I mean, this material is coming right from the mantle, and it's got all these primary minerals in it. And so there's been lots of reports in the past where people say, oh, my berries were so great the next year after an eruption. Again, these sort of finer ash balls can be quite useful for fertilizing soils. So one idea for cleanup, if we just have a few millimeters, is to mix it in to throw it into your yard, into the green spaces around your home, into your gardens or whatever, and that will most likely create better soils.
We had an email question wondering, have the Alaska Volcano Observatory and the Alaska Earthquake Observatory been impacted by federal budget and staffing cuts?
We have not directly been impacted by that because of our public safety mandate. And so we've been very fortunate so far to be able to do our jobs and stay focused. And this response has been a great distraction to all of that. And we're thankful that we can continue to do our work.
All right. We have a call from Brenda in Deering. Hi, Brenda.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm getting treatments for cancer. I have to go down next week, and I wonder if that would have any impact on the health of a person with cancer.
Dr. Conway?
Well, I think it would depend on what type of cancer you have, what type of treatments you're undertaking. I think it's a very reasonable concern. I think talking to either your primary care doctor or your oncologist, is they don't want to bother or offend you by taking a medical history over the phone.
Yeah, of course. But Christy, yes.
I guess an indirect impact that you might experience is just to aviation. So if you're trying to get to Anchorage for a treatment, you may not be able to, or if you're here and need to get back home. So that's usually a sort of a cascading effect from eruptions, is just the impacts to aviation.
And that's absolutely something the hospitals are thinking about and working on, is if it impacts medevac to Anchorage.
Yeah,
sure.
Dr. Conway.
One other thing we talked about before the broadcast, it's important if you have a chronic illness or you're being treated for a serious illness, that you have an adequate supply of your prescription medicines and any other measures. If you're oxygen dependent, you'd certainly want to have more of that. If you're insulin dependent, or if you have respiratory illness such as asthma or whatnot, you want to be sure that you have enough medicines. So if you do go out of state for that treatment, bring back enough inventory of what you need to thrive for a longer period of time.
Absolutely. Brenda, good luck with being able to travel when you need to. So hopefully Mount Spur will behave itself. We had an email from Jeff who says, fishing vessels near Umnak Island reported shoveling ash from boat decks during the 2008 eruption. He writes, I recognize this program is directed toward greater populated areas, but rural areas may be affected greatly.
Yeah, that's a really important observation. So when we're working with the Weather Service, who are responsible for warning messages of ash fall, they also provide warnings to mariners, and in particular mariners who are transiting, moving all over the place. We've just recently updated the messaging and the warnings associated with ash falls that might actually feel like rock falls. If you're transiting very near an active volcano that's in eruption, say Shishaldin or Okmok or any volcano, really, so that those warning messages are more clear how much ash to expect and actually even the particle size. So ash is 2 millimeters and smaller, but in 2023, what was coming out of the sky and falling on people's heads in boats was, rocks that you could hold in your hand. And so, that's an important recommendation or recognition. And I think someone brought up, ashfall in Tyonek, closer to the volcano. Yes, that's really important. The person who mentioned, it was 3 to 6 inches. Well, yeah, over in Tyonic it may have been. So depending on where that person was reporting from, the thicker ash falls are going to occur closer to the volcano. Sure. And then in South Central, where we're mostly talking about, we're talking about millimeter scale, but certainly those communities quite close or boats can experience certainly more ash fall.
And in our final minute here, the state, the city, AVO, NWS, all working together, it's important for folks to get to the right source for answers. If people have questions about whether they should drive to their kids' school or go across town, where is the best spot for that type of information for them?
When it comes to the schools, the school themselves, they have a plan. They're working on it. I know that my children are in the Mat-Su School District, and they sent out an email just recently about how they're working on their plans. For the most frequently asked questions, though, ready.alaska.gov, the state website, is really the primary point to go. We have all been working together to make sure that we're all on the same message and all communicating through the state to consolidate.
All right, and we'll link to those sources on our website. Dr. Conway, for folks who you mentioned wearing swim goggles outside to protect your eyes, and I would imagine that goes doubly for people who wear contacts, correct?
Yeah, certainly if you wear contacts, you want to take them off before you go outside in an ash fall. It would really could compound the problem. And the swim goggles aren't a best practice recommendation. It's just something that you may have at hand. And the advantage they have over the normal safety goggles is because they make a good seal. But, I mean, the swim goggles are plastic. They're going to get scratched. So don't wear your best prescription ones. But definitely the contacts is something you'd want to take your contacts off and use. If you have eyeglasses, use those instead. If you have to use contacts, then donning your goggles that are a good fit well before you go outside. And then when you come inside, you'd want to turn your head sideways and pour water, irrigate from your faucet so you weren't, as you're taking it off, putting a whole bunch of ash in your eyes.
And we did have a question. We only have about a minute here, but we had a question about solar panels. And I imagine that you would want to spray water on them. Is that right? Just like you would for any kind of windows or glass or windshields. You don't want to wipe or use windshield wipers. Bad idea.
Right on, Lori. That's it, right? So just using water to remove things, keeping in mind that water demand is going to be high and we want to try our best to conserve it. But yes, removing ash with water is the best practice.
And if there's two or three things that you would recommend in a few seconds here about what folks should have in their kit.
Bottled water.
Extra masks.
Goggles.
Cleaning supplies.
And then there's lots of recipes on the web for how to do your own indoor air filter and filtration with a box fan and a filter or whatever.
Yeah, so stock up on extra.
It's a great time, if you do have an emergency preparedness kit, it's a great time to go through it and make sure everything is up to date.
Make sure those granola bars aren't outdated.
And activities for the children, too.
Yes.
To ooh, excellent. Say fun games.
Yes.
That's what I was going to say.
Fun games.
Enjoy yourself.
Yes. All right, thank you so much to my guest today, Dr. George Conway, Chief Medical Officer for the Municipality of Anchorage, Christy Wallace, who is a volcanologist with the Alaska Volcano Observatory, and Carrie Wiedeker is the Anchorage Disaster Recovery Coordinator for the municipality. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde. Our producer was Annie Fite today. And on the phones, Ava White helped us out. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for joining us today. Have a great week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org.
Funding for KSDP is made possible in part by the King Cove Corporation, operating the Fleets, Inn Hotel, the Heart Lakes Apartments, and the Last Hook Off Tavern. The King Cove Corporation is a proud sponsor of KSDP.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sand Point, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
It's time now for your weather, tide predictions, and sunrise and sunset. Starting with your coastal water forecast, courtesy of the National Weather Service of Anchorage, Alaska. From Sitkanap to Castle Cape, small craft advisory today. Today, northwest winds 30 knots, sea 6 feet. Tonight, northwest